Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here, Paleo Solution Podcast. Six listeners can't be wrong. I can't believe you guys are still listening to this, particularly after today's show with the handsome, devilishly smart Dr. Kirk Parsley. Doc, what's going on?
Oh, not much, baby. I'm getting through all these projects that I've signed up for, overcommitted myself. I know you probably don't know anything about that, but
yeah, it's funny.
Just kind of saying yes to everybody who wants your help.
It's funny how we end up chumming around with each other, and neither of us can pick one project and stick to it to completion. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think I even promised like a textbook chapter to some douche I know trying to do some cert. I don't know. I needed one more thing to add to my list. So, yeah, I mean, I'm geeking out on this TED Talk coming up, and trying to make sure that goes as well as it can. And I don't know, what's it been? Probably a year. I've been launching my website next week. So hopefully this is truly the week. I figure I'm just going to get some minimal viable product up there. I'm never going to do anything that satisfies me. So I'm just going to put something up there.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go
let other people drive it.
I'm just going to grab docparsley.blogspot.com. And then just start, I'll get Wellborn, who's amazingly good with Photoshop, like, you know, putting in penises next to the person's face and stuff like that. I'm going to grab every photo I can find of you on the interwebs and then have Wellborn just like spackle in penises and interesting things around you. And that'll be docparsley.blogspot.com or something.
That'll be perfect, man.
Cool.
And that'll be much more entertaining than my side, I'm sure. and probably more informative even. It'll at least show us what Photoshop is capable of.
Particularly Wellborn's skill set with Photoshop.
Wellborn definitely has a unique spin on Photoshop.
Yes.
Yeah, and I finally found a company worth working with. It's not all smarmy. Get that the sleep product that that we've been discussing for 2 years.
Two years,
I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was obvious you and I were never going to get it done. And then you start talking to all these snake oil salesmen and greasy used car salesmen. You're like, oh man, I don't know. So I finally found a cool company that should be coming out pretty soon, and I'm pretty stoked about that, man. That'll save me at least 6,000 hours a week of emailing people what dosages to take of which supplement.
Well, people used to ask me that, but now I just send them to you. So
yeah, and I appreciate that.
Yes,
I appreciate
sure
that
do.
Greatly. Because
Kirk, I can help you with your social media presence here.
We all need to have 4,000 unread emails at any time in our inbox. That's the goal of success, or that's the measure of success, right?
Exactly.
There. Yeah. So,
Doc pinged me a couple of weeks ago. Could have been a month ago. I'm not actually sure. I've been in a delirious haze lately, but wanting to talk about some of the highly questionable hormone replacement therapy studies that have kind of come up lately. And Doc and I were discussing what we were going to talk about today and what it's going to be. It's going to be like going to a tapas bar. It's going to be a little taste of this and a little taste of that. And we're not really going to go particularly deep on anything unless both of us actually start getting more than two cylinders firing on this thing. So that's the prelude to where we're going, I guess.
Yeah, we should have done this thing at noon when we were both awake, a little more awake. But well, you know, but I think it's a good way to go. And there's so much information out there. And then for every bit of information, I guess there's 10 bits of misinformation. And it's just hard to know. It's hard to know where the people need the most help right now. I mean, I guess it's all driven by the media blurbs, which is kind of where that TRT thing came from, which just absolutely infuriated me. I remember getting the paper and I don't know if the lay audience is really up on this new technique that the quote unquote medical journals and peer reviewed journals are up to. But you know, they release these little sound bites to you know, newspapers and you know, public media before they release the paper.
Right.
So it's like two weeks to a month before before you release the paper, and then they throw out something really controversial, and the media jumps all over it, and then I get like 300 emails and calls from patients like, "Oh my God, it's the papers. I read the New York Times this morning, and it looks like I'm going to die from what we've been doing for the last 6 months." And I'm like, "Okay, well, let me read the paper before we make the decision on how soon you're going to die." Yeah, and that's really what spun me up on that one. It was just this.
Well,
I mean,
Doc, give folks a little bit of your background. We've talked about it a little bit before, but paint a little bit of the picture of how you came to start looking at, like trying to, you kind of buy into this idea that a normal, youthful hormonal profile is probably a good thing, right? Yeah, I mean, how did you arrive at that? Like, that's crazy talk. Like, I've talked to a number of physicians that are totally cool with statins and Xanax and different things, but if the person looks hypogonadic and you want to do HCG injections and DHEA plus Arimidex to try to turn on their own endogenous testosterone production, we're talking mainly a male in this case, these people will freak out about that. They're like, they're going to have a pituitary tumor. And I'm like, you're shitting me. You'll give them statins, but. So
I mean,
give folks a little background about how you got to all this stuff.
So that's probably a good place to start as any. I mean, so I think, obviously, the six or seven listeners that grabbed onto whatever podcast we've done before, I think we've done two in the past. I think we mainly geeked out on sleep on those. I can't remember exactly what it was, since it was yet another unplanned Rob Wolf, Kirk Parsley event where we just started
Like all of our
blabbering
business
on
ventures
about
together, too.
whatever was in our heads at the moment. So I mean, it really all comes from the same source, and really, I mean, the reason I really got into sleep was almost as a guise, right? It was interesting when I got. When I got back to the SEAL teams as their physician, I knew these guys had a ton of sleep problems because it was like the most prescribed, pharmaceutical there was Ambien, and it was like by a long shot. I started trying to figure out, what could be going on with these guys sleep-wise, and of course I knew nothing about sleep because no physicians do. Unless it's their specialty, you don't learn anything about it in medical school. So I really started geeking out on sleep and like, if sleep is causing all these problems that they're talking to me about, which are all, the metabolic syndrome and hypogonadic syndrome, stuff that we talk about, increased anxiety and lower energy and body composition shifts and, exercise tolerance going down and strength going down and focus and memory and sex drive and like all that stuff, which you can say is caused by maybe head injuries or maybe sleep deprivation or maybe there's some true metabolic brokenness going on from nutrition or alcohol or so it was this quagmire. But I knew sleep was in there, so I started really geeking out on sleep, and then I'm like, all right, well, enough about how we sleep. Let's, why do we sleep? And then when you start looking at that, it's like it's pretty convincing that the most important thing about sleep is sort of rebooting the computer for the next day, right? And that's like getting all the hormones back up that have been depleted through the day, and getting rid of all the toxins that have built up, to get you through the day. So whether that's neurotoxins from, using your big brain all day, or whether that's lactic acid, in your muscles, replenishing glycogen stores, all that stuff. But that's all obviously it's all hormonally driven. But the military, being a very conservative organization, as they are, they weren't even, you know, they wouldn't even have considered letting me stand up in front of people and talk about hormones, because that's everybody's biggest fear, is that we're going to have, you know, a bunch of roid raging seals running
Super
around
seals.
crushing people in Coronado, you know, in lines at Starbucks, you know, on mass killing sprees, because we all know that, you know, we all know that normal high testosterone levels just leads to mass murders and roid rage. So that's really how I kind of got into it. And then, you know, what I found just sort of clinically, and you know, I trained at every extreme, right? So I went all the way up to, you know, I won't mention the names of some of the questionable anti-aging type organizations that people have all heard of, that are just like, yeah, boom, get, you know, give guys like 200 milligrams of testosterone every 3 days and give them growth hormone and this and that, and you load them up with every hormone, super physiologic, and surprisingly, they feel great. It's like, well, you could, and you know, my argument to that is, well, if I gave them cocaine every day, they'd probably feel pretty damn good too. I don't think that would make me a very good doctor, though.
It might be a
And
limited run, both for them and for you. Yeah.
exactly. And then, you know, and then all the way down to like the super esoteric, well, you know, this is just mindfulness, you know, training, growing your roots of your feet into the earth and becoming one with the universe, and that will repair all of your issues, and you know, kind of everything in between, alternative CAM, interventional endocrinology, people are calling it now, anti-aging, kind of that whole world. And you and I, of course, know that nutrition is just an enormous player in this. And to try to extract nutrition from the problem is just absolutely laughable. But you know what I found just through clinical practice is, you know, for one thing, you know, the military is not going to allow me to put a 28-year-old guy on testosterone, even if his testosterone is 300, because they say, well, that's normal, right? And I say, well, actually, that's really not normal. You should age adjust this, and I don't know the reason for it exactly, but some curves are age adjusted and some curves aren't age adjusted. And so something like testosterone, they say, well, it's just normal for that to be really low when you get older. And you know, and my argument is, well, it's normal for your teeth to fall out too if you don't brush them and floss them. So, you know, we have the capability to sort of, you know, keep this stuff within the normal range, you know, within the higher end of normal range. And when you look over the data, I mean, and you know, and one of the big problems with alternative, you know, as they call it, alternative healthcare, and I think I introduced you to Rush Jaffe, who's one of the guys who sort of founded that field, and he worked for NIH, and their big problem was, you know, the charter of NIH is to study disease, and therefore any funding that they provide to anyone else has to be the study of disease, and any research they do has to be the study of disease. So you can't study health. So what's optimal, you know? So I just basically decided, you know, I will go with optimal being the guys that I see running around that are performing the best and don't have any problems. That, you know, that's optimal. And if you look at that, that's youthful. And when I see guys, you know, when you see these, you know, sort of an, you know, anomalies in the SEAL teams, guys that can handle the job, you know, that can be like true meat eating SEALs for 25 years. And you look at these guys, you know, their hormones look the same as the 25-year-old guy who kind of just, you know, has only been a SEAL for a couple of years. And you look at the guys who are broken, their hormones look like, you know, the
Mine.
75-year-old man. It's like, yeah, just
They
like
look like
this
me.
is like, hey, are you sure these are yours and not your dad's labs? I mean, like these are, or your daughter's, like you have a prepubescent daughter, right? Maybe these are hers. Yeah. You know, so that's really where I got into it. And then, you know, my approach, to everything is very in line with yours, right? It's just that, you know, we evolved to be on this planet, to be in this game, and we can probably handle our environment if we stick to the basics of what we evolved to be able to do. And so, to me, it's about, minimal intervention for pharmaceuticals, definitely, but minimal intervention in general, right? So it's like you don't advise people when they're starting on the paleo diet. You're not going to say, well, this is the healthiest meat, and this is the healthiest fat, and this is the healthiest vegetables. So you're only eating these three things for the rest of your life, right? It's like there's this wide variety of stuff that you can use, but you want to make it as simplistic as it possibly can. And the general concept is just like, hey, let's move towards what we know optimal is. And we know these things are really bad, and people can geek out on, whether this grain is truly paleo or not. And it's like, I don't care if that grain's truly paleo or not. If it's affecting people's guts, then it's not something I want them to be doing.
Right.
And hormones are the same way. It's like, it is a total testosterone, which is a number I don't even really care that much, but for simple terms, is a total testosterone of 700 a good enough total testosterone? Well, I don't know. I mean, how's the guy performing? My goal is, well, let's see how high we can get this guy's testosterone without giving him testosterone, and that's probably optimal for him, right? If your body's not going to make any more, then what I would say, whatever your peak your body's going to make is probably the evolutionary ideal, would be sort of my approach to it, which
Doc,
is why I don't buy into this super physiologic dosing that a lot of guys do. It's like, if a total testosterone of 4,000 was ideal, our testicles would produce that much, and there you would see guys running around with 4,000, and nobody does, right? And then there's just tons of research that shows like your disease risk and everything is so much lower, talking, total risk, individual risk alongside of relative risk. The higher you get sort of in that testosterone path, bell curve for men, the farther to the right you shift. There's sort of an ideal range for estrogen. There's sort of an ideal range for DHEA. And if you just start looking at all these and you go, and the same's true for women. When you start balancing women's hormones, you look at it and you're like, well, it really seems like everybody feels really great when their hormones are about the same as they were when they were 25-ish,
Right.
Go figure. And who didn't kind of feel their best around then? So,
Doc, people frequently, there is this sense of a almost planned obsolescence in the human, physiology. Clearly, we age. Everybody ages. Things break down at some point. But when you look at some long-lived cultures like the Okinawans, they tend to have very high DHEA levels into advanced age, and then also concomitant with that, good testosterone profile in men, good testosterone, estrogen, progesterone profile in women, even postmenopausal, which is kind of interesting. Talk to folks a little bit about, why, even though there's kind of a planned wind down, it may be quite a bit different than what we're seeing today. And you had mentioned to me some papers that you saw of, I think this was specifically on men, but maybe two generations ago, like our grandparents or great grandparents, and that the male testosterone levels, even in the 60s, 70s, was quite a bit different than what it is now.
Yeah, so that was and that goes way back for me. So I'd have to look up the exact articles I pulled on that. But we know for a fact that male testosterone levels are declining. I have a very strong suspicion that this has to do a lot to do with our sleep declining, and all, obviously the problems with sleep deprivation go hand in hand with hormone depletion. But I want to say it was like around, yeah, it was probably the 60s. I think it was Framingham data primarily is where that was coming from. And I think the average, and this was total testosterone, which again, we can get into that if you think it's appropriate. We can get into like the differences in what we're really marking and what we're looking for and what's valuable to track and what's not. But the total testosterone was about 50% lower, since like 1960-ish, and just the average male when you take all comers. And the sperm count was ridiculous. Like the sperm count had gone from an average of 150 million down to about 30 million in the course of just like 40 or 50 years. It's like our grandfathers had 50% more testosterone and 5 times more sperm than we did at our age right now. And that probably has a lot to do with not only this, the sleep, but also all the stuff we know about the zeoestrogens affecting, the sexual unbinding globulin, which, like you said, I don't know if you want to spin that far down the rabbit hole in this
Yeah,
stuff,
let's
getting
do
into
it.
those
Let's
things.
do it.
But same, like when you go to Starbucks and you get that piping hot, crappy coffee. I hate Starbucks coffee, but people seem to drink it. So, anyways, when you go get your piping hot Starbucks coffee and you put that little plastic lid on there, you're just giving yourself a nice little dose of a pseudoestrogen every single time that hot water or that hot coffee goes across that plastic lid. Our cars, that new car smell, that's your testosterone dropping with every whiff.
Especially if you drive a Subaru Forester like I do, so.
Exactly. Yeah. Plastics, and then of course the pesticides and the hormones that we use in livestock, and all. I mean, there's something ridiculous. It's like either eight. I think it's 80,000. It's either 80. I'm pretty sure it's 80,000, but it might be as low as 8,000. Just like normal everyday environmental toxins that you run across, like. So how are you ever going to extrapolate yourself from that? And you can't, right? So I can't ever tell people, well, we've just got to lower your zeoestrogen content, exposure. I couldn't even put you in a plastic bubble, right? Because that's the
That's
exposure. It's the problem,
the
right? So like, how are we going to do this? So what one of the things that does is, as the name suggests, is that it acts like estrogen. It's a pseudoestrogen, a zeoestrogen, a neoestrogen. I don't care what they want to call it these days. It's all the same thing. And it basically means this product, this substance gets into your body, however it gets into your body. And of course, there's lots of ways that can happen. And it behaves like estrogen. And what we know in men is that really the more important number is for testosterone isn't the total testosterone, but the free testosterone or what's called the bioavailable. So if you think about, your bloodstream sort of being like a high security, hallways, everything going through the bloodstream is escorted by some sort of protein that's identifying this as part of yourself. So your body doesn't, attack it. And there's a little bit of free testosterone that's not attached to anything, and that can just diffuse right into a cell, right? It doesn't require a receptor to get through the external membrane, and then it binds to a receptor in there, then gets into the nucleus and does its thing. And the bioavailable testosterone is that free testosterone plus any testosterone that's bound to albumin, which probably most of your guests know is just a sort of a normal blood protein that escorts lots of things around. And so it's sort of loosely bound and it can break off. And this is probably like that second wind that people talk about. It's like, you reach a threshold where you've exhausted your intracellular ability to convert DHEA into testosterone on demand. And now you're just essentially leaching it all off of this albumin, and you kind of get that aggro sort of surge in whatever sort of sport you're doing. So that's bioavailable. Free is, without the albumin. So those two numbers are really the ones to track. The problem with the total is all of those zeo and neoestrogens that we're talking about, those raise a protein called sex hormone binding globulin. And that protein irreversibly binds, drum roll please, sex hormones. Therefore, it's called sex hormone binding globulin. And it binds estrogen and it binds testosterone and it binds a ton of the intermediaries, of which, we definitely won't go into that down that rabbit hole, but there's about 27 intermediaries all along that pathway. Getting that number down, which is why I don't geek out too much about the total testosterone, because what I'm worried about is what is your body seeing? What are you able to get access to, and that's, you know, stuff that's bound to albumin and stuff that's free. So we know that the male sex hormone binding globulin levels have gone up astronomically. And some of this is, you know, some of this happens once you become metabolically broken and you start producing a lot of estrogen, and some of this is from estrogen, you know, the pseudoestrogens in the environment. But what we know is as this number creeps up, you could have a total testosterone of 1,000, right? And your doctor would say, dude, you are fine. Like, you're good to go. That's an amazing number. And, you know, you must be feeling great. But if your sex hormone binding globulin is like 150, then what your cells is actually seeing is almost nothing. And if you look back at things like Framingham data, and you know, people even starting to get metabolically broken there, but you know, if you trace it back just even a little further, men just really didn't have sex hormone binding globulin, which is, I mean, he had a level of about 10 to 15, which is why there's a big argument sort of in the HRT replacement as to whether or not whether or not you can use something called the free androgen index, which is a way to sort of kind of include more than bioavailable testosterone. We're talking about sort of all androgens. We're getting all the way back kind of to DHEA and all the way as far forward as DHT. And we've used that on women for a really long time, but there was this argument that you can't, that wasn't valid on men. But sex hormone binding globulin in men now, I see literally as high as women all the time. So now it makes sense to use that number. And so that's what I usually track off of. And then that just, it makes the game much more complex. And what it really does is removes the possibility that you're, you know, it just makes it extraordinarily unlikely that you're getting really good care from a guy who took a weekend course on, you know, hormone replacement therapy. You know, it just gets really, really intricate. One of those studies that infuriated me, I remember I was sitting at my son's football game and my head was just literally tingling as I was reading this. I'm just like going, oh, this is New England Journal of Medicine. You got to be kidding me. If you looked at the funders of the study, you could dismiss it out of hand already. But you read through it and it was this it was this thing, whether or not men need estrogen blockers if they're getting testosterone therapy. And it turns out that estrogen blockers make you worse. This is their conclusion. And I'm like, yeah, this does not match at all what I found clinically. And, you start reading through the study. And they basically went in there and chemically induced panhypopit, right? So they really just shut down their ability to produce any hormones for like 8 weeks or something, and then started giving people testosterone and some of them estrogen blockers. And the people who didn't do well literally had no estrogen. Like, it was not measurable. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I will grant you that you do need some estrogen. That whole thing was based on this attack on all the gels, all the topical gels. And creams, because when you put that on your skin, it has to go through your skin, which means it has to go through your subcutaneous fat, which is where men carry, and women too, but it's the biggest player in men. It's where men carry the aromatase enzyme that's converting their testosterone into estrogen. And so certain companies who sell these products want to disprove this myth that their products don't work well because they raise estrogen levels more than or as much as they raise testosterone, and that, which then raises the sex hormone binding globulin and makes people feel no better than they felt, you know, 4 months after they started. When they first started, testosterone spikes, they feel great. 4 months later, they're like, I don't feel any better, or maybe I feel worse. And so they went to disprove this. And the population that did the best was the one that they allowed to get up to sort of free run with their estrogen. But their estrogen only got up to a normal level, which you would have expected for a man who you were treating well, which was a level of like 10 to 15. And the people who did poorly, they had like zero estrogen. So go figure, they actually needed something that their body had been producing for 50,000 years. And that one infuriated me. Then there was the other one with the oh man, this one was a killer. This one was New York Times. And I think the article, I think it was a New England Journal article as well. They basically said that, taking exogenous testosterone increases your risk for heart attacks, and this was their conclusion, and it was just there, like, here you go. And then you read through the data, and you're like, I have no idea how you came up with this conclusion. It reminds me of the China study, where you just kind of observe a population for a long time and say, oh, well, these people have these benefits, so it must be from this. And so they went back into this huge retrospective cohort of all these different studies, basically looked for any man who had been prescribed testosterone. They didn't say how much testosterone, what kind of testosterone, why he was prescribed testosterone, what other health issues he had, why did he go see the doctor in the first place. And then they made this broad statement that,
And they never
take take
validated that they ever increased testosterone levels
yeah
in the
like
system, right?
there were no serum levels associated with it. They didn't measure your blood, and like, are these guys even using the testosterone? If they are, are they going super physiologic? And then, the result was just comical. It was basically like, well, if you're 65 or older and you take testosterone, it's going to kill you. You're gonna have an MI. And if you're younger than 65, because somehow your body knows exactly, like, here's the point where I'll no longer accept testosterone at age 65, 65th birthday, I'm gonna die if you give it to me now. So they have no idea, like, how much these guys were doing, what else they're doing, what led to their house, what led to them getting this prescription in the first place, how high their levels were going. And they studied them for 3 months and said, there seems to be an increase of heart attacks after this, in this 3 month period. Interestingly enough, after the 3 months, you had a lower risk of heart attack, no matter what your age was, right? And I'm like, all right, well, this is kind of counterintuitive. If testosterone is causing the problem, you have to admit that it's kind of a leap to say that it'll only kill you for 3 months, and then after that, it's going to save your life. There's probably a correlation between the guys who had heart attacks, why they got testosterone in the first place, why they were seeing the doctor, what their complaints were. Obviously an older guy is more likely to have cardiovascular disease, and maybe his complaints were all, cardiovascular in the first place. And that was the doctor's solution, right? I mean,
So you're
obviously
saying somebody metabolically broken might be more likely to have lower testosterone levels and generally feel like shit?
Yeah, it's shocking. It really is shocking. Again, back to the tooth analogy, people who don't brush their teeth or floss them and lose all their teeth, they seem to have a much more difficult time chewing meat than the rest of us. So it's absolute crazy talk, but it just really seems to be a strong correlation between keeping your body, as youthful appearing metabolically as possible. But
So okay, to that point,
that's craziness.
it's total crazy. So let's do devil's advocate on that. I met a guy recently, super high profile guy, very wealthy. He had bumped into some people. This guy's 54, 55, in pretty darn good shape. But the folks that he bumped into, they're like, dude, you need to be on growth hormone, testosterone, thyroid, myostatin gene knockout, which actually when that stuff comes out, I'm all over that, but that's a whole other gig. But they just wanted to throw the full bucket at this guy. And I was just like, why don't you talk to Doc Parsley and we'll do a little poking around here and just kind of see what you've got going on. And so in my mind, and I think you've already mentioned this, minimum intervention, minimum effective dose, try to get the body's own machinery to get working to the best of the ability, just kind of goose instead of lasso and drag along. So why not just go full, completely ridiculous, over the top on this stuff? What's if we're saying that youthful levels are good, why aren't super physiological levels better? Why not just go completely hog wild on this stuff?
Yeah, well, again, I mean, it goes to me. It's the whole sort of ancestral gig, right? If being 9 feet tall was kind of the ideal evolution, we would be 9 feet tall. And if total testosterone of 4,000 was ideal, you would see that. The fact that we live around 1,000 when we're young means that it's probably about as high as you want to go. And that's a conceptual thing that, I can't prove any more than anyone else. But what we do know is that, super physiologic doses of anything usually carries with it some sort of side effect, because you can't just affect one thing, right? Like, I can't just say, well, I'm going to take your testosterone up to 4,000 and leave everything, and that's only going to affect your testosterone. Well, that's obviously horseshit. That's going to affect like 600 other hormones and neurotransmitters and thought processes and, brain region activation, and all sorts of things are going to be, sort of screwed with. So, to me, it's like, will that enhance your performance? Yes. That's why professional athletes take them. They want to be Superman. Is that sustainable? Absolutely not. I mean, how many really great looking, fit, well balanced ex-professional athletes do you see? It's very tough on your body to do that. And to me, it just doesn't really make sense, right? If you want to be, the world's strongest man, then you're probably going to need to take just about every kind of drug that's ever been invented, and you're on your own with that. But if you're talking about, well, we're trying to, live the longest, happiest, fullest life we possibly can, and be as healthy as we possibly can, and basically we want to die young as late as possible in our life, right? So we want to be like really young at 85 and just keel over and just feel great. So to me, that, the simple solution there is, well, let's reapproximate youth the best we can, but let's use your body's equipment to do that in any way we possibly can. And not to beat this frickin' tooth metaphor to death, but it would be analogous to saying, well, you have poor dental hygiene. You haven't been taking care of your teeth. Let's just rip all these bastards out and put implants in, or dentures or whatever, and we will make your teeth absolutely perfect, and they would be the nicest looking teeth you could ever possibly have. That's kind of what they're doing with hormones. It's like, well, let's just make you super physiologic, but we know that growth hormone goes to IGF-1, right? And IGF-1 is pretty well linked to cancer risk. There's sort of an ideal range, but you start getting that super physiologic. I have some reasonable doubt as to whether or not that's a safe route to go. Testosterone has all sorts of problems, and what a lot of these places do when they go super physiologic is they saturate your body's ability to use the testosterone anyways. And just like anything else, you just start down-regulating receptors, which then makes you less sensitive to testosterone. So now you're probably putting, about three times what your body needs in there, and your body's only willing to use about a quarter of it anyways. And it's really, I think, just sort of a money-making kind of scheme. These guys have their own pharmacies. They charge a huge amount of money for, pharmaceuticals that cost nothing. When I do put somebody on testosterone, I think a vial of testosterone is like $50 or something. And for my patients, that's 20 injections, right? So, I mean, that's like, it's 20 weeks for $50. And at some of these places where they just want to bomb people with everything, they're spending like $2,000 a month on all these hormones. But there's ways, and I won't even work with people if they aren't willing to optimize their sleep and nutrition and fitness first, right? Because if you're not willing to do that, then we're philosophically at odds, and I'm not going to be able to help you, because unless you're willing to put that time in, everything I do is kind of a waste of time. Once we've optimized all that, guess what? A lot of your hormones and stuff come back into place anyways, and a lot of your risk markers go down. You know, your oxidation and inflammation go down, and a lot of your anabolic stuff goes up. So some people, I mean, it's really not that uncommon for a really young guy, if you just optimize their lifestyle, their nutrition, and their sleep, and, you know, and get them to quit, you know, working out till they puke every day. You do a few simple interventions like that, and all of a sudden, like, they're back on top of the world, and you look at their labs, and lo and behold, their labs look like they should. You know, they look like a 25-year-old again. And then people who can't quite get there, you know, let's look at what deficits are. You know, look where the deficits are. And we know that people's DHEA tends to decline over time. And that's primarily declining because we're using it to make testosterone, because we're not sleeping well, because we're not, which means we're not secreting testosterone when we should. And we have these high sex hormone binding globulins and the bioavailability and all that other stuff we talked about. So let's give this guy DHEA. And guess what? If his estrogen is, you know, 10 times higher than it should be, let's block that estrogen. And that's one of the signaling pathways for his body to make more testosterone. And then let's see what his body can do. And if, you know, and if we can get him up into the upper quintile, you know, the upper 20% of that bell curve on sort of the anabolic parameters, and the lower 20% on sort of the oxidative inflammation and, you know, other type of risk variables. If we can do all that with his body's own equipment or her body's own equipment, then why wouldn't you do that? And then that's sustainable for, you know, infinitum. You know, at some point your testicles will just quit, but that's probably, you know, 65, 75 kind of range. And at that point, okay, you know, you still want to go out and be a big time age grouper in some sort of sport, that's probably going to be necessary for you. But, you know, it's, you know, it's probably the same argument that you would have with somebody over nutrition versus supplements, right? Why can't I just eat McDonald's and take, you know, Athletic Greens and make sure I get all my nutrients that way, and you know, supplement, you know, or you know, why can't I be a vegan and supplement with whey protein? Like, you know, there's just a normal way that we've evolved to do it, and it seems to me like, you know, we're not nearly as smart as however many billions of years the planet's been evolving. We should probably just kind of stick to the game plan and play the hand we're dealt, and optimize that. And so that's my approach on all that. And the other beauty of that is, if, you know, we work together for a year, 2 years, something like that, and then you say, you know what, I'm giving up on the dream. I'm going to go be a coconut farmer in Colombia or something like that. Then guess what? You're still better off than the day you met me. Where, you know, if somebody says, "Hey, you need a gram of testosterone every week, and, you know, 5 IUs of growth hormone every day," guess what? You're not making next year, right?
Or like, ever, possibly,
or
again.
ever again, right? It's like, okay, well, you quit that. Yeah, you've quit it for life. You know, you're going to be way worse off than you've ever been in your life. It's just going to, you know, completely implode. So that's my rationale for doing it the way I do it.
No, I mean, it intuitively it makes a ton of sense to me. I think that's part of why we had the immediate bromance when we met at the gigs that we were both involved with. It's fascinating to me, and you and I talk about this a fair amount, and it's kind of funny when you mentioned guys not working out till they puke. I was like, oh, mental note, need to ask Doc about CrossFit, which was funny. Like, literally just that moment, I was like, need to ask Doc about CrossFit. But, you know, there's we get so much kind of input, you know, media input, Facebook input, stuff like that, where we see probably performances and physiques that are, you know, outside the normal physiological bounds. And then to some degree, that starts becoming the norm, or at least your
Right.
internalized norm, you know, and
Right.
there's all the
Exactly.
kind of body dysmorphia stuff, or, you know, whatever. So it's kind of interesting. So I think that when I was more hands-on with folks, particularly when I would deal with people who are cyclists in particular, they would see these training routines of people doing Tour de France and stuff like that. And they would come in and they were just beat to death. And I'm like, what are you doing to yourself? You know, it's like, well, I saw this workout online and these guys are getting this much volume and they're doing this and they're doing that. I'm like, yeah, they're a professional athlete and you're an accountant with three kids and you're 45 years old and you smoke a lot of pot on the weekends, and, you know, and it's just like, this isn't going to work, man. Like, you know, to your point, like if these guys wanted to be kind of age group, competitive, then we could probably do some stuff like that. But trying to emulate the training volume and intensity of professional athletes, they're not going to do it because they passed that window of time and maybe they got the short end of the stick on the genetic lottery and it's just not going to happen. But I see a lot of this to some degree too on kind of reasonable expectations of success in the gym, success with body composition changes. Like you can get some very impressive physiques and you know, like natural bodybuilders, natural fitness competitors and stuff like that. But you know, with my own scene, I've noticed that if I'm willing to run, say, like 10 to 12% body fat, which is, you know, not super lean, like my abs aren't super up or something like that, then I can be like 185 pounds and pretty strong. But if I really want to look like impressively lean, then I'm like 165, 168 pounds. And that's the way it is. There's no, you know, for me to be the day that I pop up and I'm 185 pounds and 6% body fat, then I've tracked down Vinny at Planet Muscle and I've got the hookup. You know, like I've gone to the big time. I mean, what have you kind of observed that in your practice of just kind of what the reasonable expectations are from folks?
So, you know, I'll divide them into two subsets. You know, the working with SEALs is like just it's usually 99% around performance. And their performance is, you know, to some extent that you know, the guys who are really into CrossFit or something, you know, they might use that as a metric for one of their metrics for performance. But for the most part, it's like how well can they do their job, you know? Because if you go out and watch like, you know, a week of land warfare training with the SEALs, you say, I mean, CrossFit's for sissies, right? Like, I mean, there's no comparison to the anaerobic threshold and the amount of time you have to hold that. It's insanity. So, you know, the ability for these guys to do their job is really how they measure themselves. And of course, you know, some of them are young and single and want to look like underwear models to, you know, scoop the babes off the beaches and all that stuff. And so there's some vanity in there. And to some extent, but you know, usually the older guys, like you're talking about, they kind of have this expectation of, you know, they've seen this one of these shiny, glossy, airbrushed people in a magazine, and he's 85 years old, and he looks like Arnold in his prime, and he's got a spray tan on and all that, and he's like, dude, I want to look like that, and I'm like, well, guess what? You know, you're 65 years old and you're 50 pounds overweight, and that's probably not a reasonable goal for you. And like you said, you know, you're an accountant and you work 60 hours a week, and you got three kids and a wife and all sorts of other obligations. So I definitely see that. And I'm guilty of this. You know, we're all guilty of this. Like, you know, you see some sort of metamorphosis that some guy who has seems to have some similarities to you, or some gal if you're a girl, and you go, oh man, if he or she can do that, why can't I do that? And it's like, well, by and large, when I see people who have made those major transformations, that's what they've been doing with their life, you know, for those 3 or 4 months. Like, that's it. Like, they're, you know, they are calculating every calorie. They're building their lives, you know, they're building their lives around this huge fitness shift. And like you're talking about with you, like, it's just not sustainable, right? I mean, we're all kind of genetically set to where at a certain point where our body composition is going to be optimal at a certain place. And for me, like, my body composition is not optimal. My performance is not optimal at 6% body fat. Like, I've been there, and I look really lean, and I like, you know, I like looking in the mirror and going, yeah, that's like, that's ripped up. But my performance is nowhere near as good as when, you know, my abs are fairly smooth and I'm at 12% body fat. I can get after it a lot longer and a lot harder, and I'm a lot stronger. And so, you know, unfortunately, that's just kind of where I sit, you know. And the expectation that, you know, we can all look the same would be no different than to say, you know, if I really take care of myself, you know, can't I be as handsome as Brad Pitt? You know, like, no, you're Brad Pitt is genetically handsome and you're not, you know, like you're not a good looking guy. Let's just face that. You know, you're not a super fit, lean, athletic guy. I mean, I know this one guy who's literally, he's a professional model, like a fitness model, and he just ripped all the time, right? And I literally see this guy sit down and eat like, you know, 3 bags worth of Taco Bell, you know, drinking his, you know, his giant soda, while playing video games. And I'm just like, okay, well, you know, like that's that guy's story. That's what he's got going on. But definitely, you know, it's true across the world, right? It's just that, you know, comparing yourself to others is probably the least likely way to feel good about yourself and your performance gain, you know, or your gains. I mean, you should be comparing yourself to, you know, either your prime or you should be, you know, measuring your progress. And as long as you're making progress, that's what really drives happiness. I mean, I find it time and time again. I mean, you can be the, you know, the beautiful glossy person in Hollywood or whatever. And, you know, how many of those people seem to be truly happy with their lives? I mean, the true truly the thing that makes us happy is doing things that we want to do and getting better at them. And as long as you're making progress, who cares if you have a 6-pack or a 4-pack or a 2-pack or 1-pack? Yeah, you know, like whatever. I mean, that's my take on it. But I definitely do kind of see that scope creep. The expectations are just getting, you know, insane. And CrossFit, you know, obviously is a huge contributor to that. You know, most men would like to be as muscular as the CrossFit women, you know, and that's just kind of become normal. I mean, the elite performers. I mean, obviously some of them do it to the right degree, but you know, others, I don't really find like traps up to your ears being super sexy on women personally. But you know, who am I to judge?
But I wouldn't mind them on me.
Yeah, they'd look great on me, not so much on her. You know, there's anatomical parts that I like on myself and anatomical parts I don't like on women. So, giant traps are one of them. There's some more obvious ones, but we won't totally turn off all your listeners.
That's another rabbit hole we won't go down yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, Doc, what else? What do you have cooking? You have a TEDx talk coming up here in Reno very quickly. Can we tell people about your Europe gig?
Yeah, so well, I mean that's not available to the lay audience, but what I'm going to try to produce some sort of you know, information product off of that, like something that I can get out to you know, the lay audience, the listeners who are interested in it. But it's a, you know, that's like an 8-hour sort of CME CEU gig for healthcare providers, and it's you know, just I'd say 90, it's 90% around sleep. Has a heavy focus towards adolescents because you know, just because these are military docs that take care of you know, deployed families, and they see a lot of, you know, they're seeing a lot of problems with sleep with the adolescents. We know the military's crushed and broken with sleep, and you know, I'll build as much as the adult stuff as I can into that. Yeah, that gig's coming up in July, and then I got a lot of traveling around trying to get this sleep supplement out in late July and August. So maybe, like, you know, the end of August, I'll take a day off or something, like
Nice.
see the sun, leave my office, maybe go outside, breathe some fresh air. I don't know. I'm not overly ambitious with that. Well, it'll happen when it happens,
I was
but
going to say that's a very aggressive plan. Yeah.
I know. It is pretty aggressive. And then, yeah. And then, you know, all along the sidelines with all the free time you can imagine I have with all those things going on and my kids and my own training and all that other stuff. Like I said, I'm supposed to be producing this textbook chapter for this dude, and I'm trying to push all that along anyways. What's the date for that anyways? We
Well,
have a goal. We have a goal for that.
we're going to finalize that this week.
Gotcha.
So by the time this podcast goes up, we'll have that finalized. But Doc Parsley is going to be contributing a sleep 30,000 foot kind of view of hormonal modulation, cortisol, HPTA axis dysregulation for the upcoming certification. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I wish I could say it's my pleasure. I do anything for you, Rob. You're
Well,
my boy, but I can't make myself enjoy
those nude
that.
photos of you from Guam with Erwan Lacour, I've got those in a safe place. So that was my leverage that I had.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Hey, that was purely experimental, dude.
Hey man, no judgment here. This is Don't Ask, Don't Tell
What
podcast, so no
happens in
judgment.
Guam? No, that's Vegas.
Yeah, it actually followed you back. That was the round of antibiotics. So Well,
Yeah.
awesome, Doc. It's great having you
Absolutely.
on. We probably finally got going on to three cylinders by the end of this gig. But what do you say, maybe late fall, early winter, we bring you back on and we do a female hormonal show? Because I know this one was
Yeah,
probably
absolutely.
more directed at guys, and our female listeners get a little bit hopping mad about that. So why don't we actually do some planning for that, and we'll talk both sleep, food, exercise, and hormones just for chicks.
Yeah, that's definitely a good call.
Cool.
But the one parting shot, just to throw out there for the listeners to realize, is that sex hormones are, we all have the same sex hormones, and men have 10 times more testosterone than women. That's true. But all of the anabolic aspects of being a woman are the same as the anabolic aspects of being a man. And the dominant sex hormone in women is actually testosterone, not estrogen. That people get confused with that. Women do have a lot more estrogen than men do, but they still have 10 times more testosterone than they do estrogen. And so that's their real performance gig right there. So all of this stuff really overlaps well. It's just how you go about optimizing the women is slightly different, but the end goal is the same. When you look at a 25-year-old woman and kind of say, well, that's sort of optimal performance time for women, and maybe slightly younger in women. But it's the same kind of gig. I mean, you look at like where are their anabolic markers? Let's keep all those far to the right. Let's keep all of their sort of catabolic and oxidative and inflammatory sort of risk markers in the lowest quintile. Keep the anabolic stuff in the highest quintile. And lo and behold, they can be as lean and athletic and sexy as they ever were. And it's a very similar gig, but we'll talk more specifically about the hormone modulation piece for them. But the nutrition and the sleep and the exercise are no different. It's exactly the same. That's one area that it's just like you can't separate men and women there. It's like we all need the same amount of sleep. We all need the same nutrition. And there's a point of catabolic overtraining that hits us all at various phases, and maybe we can tinker around with sort of marking what when we know we've hit that point and we've gone too far with the training. Maybe that's something worth talking about in there too. But I don't know. I don't actually listen to your podcast, so maybe you've already geeked out on that plenty. I can't say.
I think we've mentioned it before, but it bears mentioning again. So
Yeah.
I like it. Oh, hey Doc, before we go, if somebody's going to track, what's a basic kind of androgen profile? Like, if somebody wants to track their testosterone levels, what's the kind of program minimum for so frequently, if folks may have some thyroid problems, and all that they come back with is like TSH, and it's like, okay, swing and a miss. That doesn't tell us anything. If they're
Yeah.
suspecting like some hypogonadism or something like that, what's kind of the program minimum that they got to do as far as blood work to be able to just start peeling that onion and figure out what's going on?
Yeah, so what I would, what I use for a a bare minimum for my patients, and some of these labs can just be ridiculously expensive. So I do try to put a very, very minimal panel in there. My panel is, of course, like full retard. There's like, 150 different markers on there when I do people's blood. But, for a male, like you really can't avoid getting total testosterone if you're going to measure testosterone. That's just kind of the way they run the assays. So a total testosterone, and then a free testosterone, which is usually calculated, but go ahead and let's see the number anyways. A bioavailable testosterone, which is definitely calculated. But the things that people usually miss pretty big is that we need DHEA. And DHEA sulfate is helpful, but DHEA itself, with the non-sulfonated, right? So that's a better one. So DHEA, total testosterone, bioavailable or free testosterone, or all three of those, right? But at the very minimum, free, if that's actually measured, that's great. And then we need sex hormone binding globulin so that we can compute a free androgen index. And then we need an estradiol. With those right there, I can tell you with, probably 90% certainty, kind of where you're at anabolic wise. DHT, if you want to go that one, I wouldn't call that one imperative, but it's pretty damn close. That's the most anabolic form of testosterone. And you'll find, some of my patients I find who don't have great testosterone levels, their body has compensated by really ramping up their DHT. And so if you're, considering mucking around with all of that, that's an important number to have, because if your body is doing that and we raise DHT too much, it's going to, give you acne, make you go bald and all that stuff. Let's see, there was one other thing that just hit my mind. If you're going to do, oh yeah. So if you're a male and you're looking to work on, your testosterone levels, the other thing we need to do is look at your PSA, the prostate specific antigen, because if we are, if you are going to work with your doc and raise your testosterone, whether you're doing it by, stimulating your own testicular production and blocking your estrogen production, or if you're just doing exogenous testosterone, there's always a possibility, after sort of a certain age, that you could have a testosterone sensitive tumor in your prostate. Doesn't cause prostate cancer, but if there's already prostate cancer there and it's sensitive to testosterone and we quadruple your testosterone level, guess what else is going to quadruple? And so you need to track that. But if you aren't thinking you're going to muck around with them and you just want to see where you're at, then I wouldn't be too worried about that. And especially if you're probably younger than 35, I wouldn't worry too much about the PSA.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome, Doc. Well, it was great having you on. Looking forward to seeing your TED Talk and getting to hang out with you in Reno a little bit, and probably might be able to rope you down to the Jits Academy so that you can mop the mat with me, which will be a grand time. Although I will have the altitude on my side, so.
Well, and you'll have the gi on your side. I hardly ever do the gi. I just don't spend nearly as much time in that, and I know there's all sorts of little clever tricky moves in there that I don't know.
But so most of my clever tricky moves are screaming "not in the face, not in the face." So.
All right, man.
All right, Doc.
Well,
thanks
for having me on, and we will chat again soon, I'm sure. And if not, I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay,
at the Wolf Cave.
That's right. All righty. Talk to you soon, Doc. Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye.